Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have with us Jessica Shattuck, author of The Women in the Castle, published in March by William Morrow. Jessica's previous work includes her novel, The Hazards of Good Breeding, a New York Times notable book. Her fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Glamour, many other periodicals. Her nonfiction has appeared in The Times, Mother Jones, Wired, and The Globe. The Women in the Castle explores the lives of three survivors of Hitler's Germany, Marianne, Benita, and Anya. Marianne is the natural leader, a righteous woman who's bound by a promise made to a hero, a man who wished to see his country remain a free and just one, and who decided to attempt to assassinate Adolf Hitler, an attempt that obviously failed and led to his hanging, as well as Albrecht's, Marianne's husband, and hundreds of others, if not thousands, including Anya's husband as well. Now Marianne is responsible for bringing these women and their children together to fulfill her promise to her castle, where they attempt to rebuild lives, attempts that also fail in part. Fail in part because it's an enormous task, but also because each of the women, just like each of us, is not necessarily what they seem or what we expect them to be. This dynamic drives the novel and pushes and pulls us many ways at once. Jessica places the reader in a precarious position, which is always a good thing, where we have to work out for ourselves who's right, who's wrong, who's absolved, who isn't, who's on the right side of things. And the novel is emboldened and elevated by the dilemmas it poses to us, but it's also driven forward with sheer energy and a story that captivates from, really, actually does, from the prologue to the epilogue. With that, welcome, Jessica, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So you dedicate the book to your mother and to your grandmother. Why is that?
Well, I am half German. My mother grew up in the immediate aftermath of the war in Germany. She was born in 1943, and I grew up hearing her stories of her childhood, which made a big impression on me. And when I was 15, my mother passed away, and with her, the answers to many questions that I would develop as I got older. And I spent a lot of time with my grandmother, my mother's mother, getting the chance to ask some of those questions. Obviously, she had very different answers than my mother would have, but she spent a lot of time talking to me about my mother's childhood, about that time after the war, and ultimately about the time of the war itself and what led up to it. So I don't think I would have written this book without either of them.
When you think back to your research generally, and also the research that developed naturally from the relationships you had with your mother and grandmother, do you think also of the fact that some of your immediate past family actually were or wore Nazi uniforms?
Yeah, that's a big part of what I wrestled with in writing this book. I knew I wanted to tell a story of World War II from the point of view of quote-unquote ordinary Germans, like my own grandparents, and I knew that I wanted to represent kind of, I wanted the views and attitudes and experiences of my characters to represent, sort of span the gamut of the German political experience at that time. So I did write from the point of view of some characters who were initially enamored of Hitler and joined the Nazi Party and felt a lot of excitement about his coming to power. And I also wrote from the point of view that the book is told from three primary different points of view. And then I also had a point of view of someone who saw very early on the danger that Hitler posed and was suspicious and skeptical and resisted from the start.
When you look at all this now, especially given our times, and we can talk about that some too, why do you think there still is such a fascination with people? People, you know, 70 years now gone, why is there such a fascination with not only the war, but the survivors, the aftermath, and what happened to the people who were actually involved in the country during the time. Why is it such a, why does it hold such a grasp on our psyches now?
Well, I think in the span of time, it really wasn't that long ago. 70 years is still within people's lifetimes. Although quickly, the people who, as we move further away, we're the people who experienced that time and can really tell us from a firsthand point of view about it are beginning to die out. So it feels urgent to capture this their experiences. But I also think the reason, even if this was 150 years ago, I think it is really Western civilization's most horrific cautionary tale, and we gravitate toward it and grapple with it as such.
When you began the book, and you began it some time ago, you had no idea that you'd find yourself in the political climate that we find ourselves in now, but you had made reference in some of your other interviews, so I feel comfortable in asking, how do you think the book and its message is relevant to the times we find ourselves in now?
Well, I think there are a lot of parallels between what was going on in 1930s Germany and Europe and where we are today. I also think that, just to step back from the specific parallels, which I can get into in greater detail if we want to go there, but I think we're really ready for a probing into the how of the Holocaust as well as the what, if you know what I mean. We spent a lot of time really shoring up our understanding of the horrors that transpired and the horrific stories of the victims and the stories of the Allies who liberated them and of some of the heroes in that tale. But we've spent a little less time, I think, as a society, at least in America, in English literature and English culture, we spent a little less time grappling with how did this come to pass? What were the steps that led up to these horrific events? And that feels to me as relevant now as it ever has.
And it's very scary. I mean, who would be expecting the American Holocaust Museum and the Anne Frank Society to be defending themselves at this point in time against anti-Semitism within our country and around the world in France? Who would have expected that? If you want to get into specifics, feel free to do that.
Yeah. Well, I think, interestingly, I mean, some of the parallels are they're not as direct. It's not that I think that there's a huge wave of anti-Semitism, although you could make the case there is. I'm less qualified to speak about that. If there's some major second wave of anti-Semitism sweeping the country, I think in America what we see is an anti-Muslim sentiment that very much echoes some of the anti-Semitic, the wave of anti-Semitism sweeping Germany in the 30s, and that is one that is very much stoked by a political agenda of leaders and is also fired by some conflations that are pretty dangerous. In the 1930s in Germany, there was a real fear of Bolshevism, which to us sounds like this kind of abstraction, an ideology. But at the time, there were Bolsheviks who were active. These were communist party members, certainly in the 20s even more, communists who were trying to make change in Germany. And there were riots on the street. There were actual incidents of deaths between and riots and fighting between the sort of right-wing militias and the communists. In 1919, the Bolsheviks actually took over Bavaria, and it became the Soviet Socialist Republic of Bavaria for only 2 months. But still, that's a pretty radical and huge event that was a real event, which then Hitler very successfully exploited the German people's worry about Bolshevism to conflate it with Judaism, and he kind of wrapped that up into a package. All Jews were Bolsheviks, and fired up people's anti sort of us against them sentiment in that way. And I think that you could make a case that some of that kind of thinking is happening in both Europe and America today, with particularly with Muslims.
Yeah, I think you even equated it in one interview to, you know, Hitler's own fake news program.
Oh, yeah, there was also, that's another, I mean, another parallel is for sure the fact that, Hitler was absolutely undeterred by real facts, and he was a master, as we all know, of propaganda and of you know, if he in fact authored the idea of the big lie, which was a lie that is huge and sensational enough that no one could imagine you made it up because it's so big. And I think those things are, our fear of that and the reality of fake news and people not knowing which way is up and what's really true and what isn't, are definitely alive today.
Another thing that reminded me of today was, and like I said, I really was entranced by the prologue, and it, you know, that's what, I think I might have read the book in one sitting anyway, but I did, and it was probably because the prologue drew you in, and what it does is it sets the book up, and it reminded me of those movies and books about parties during the beginning of the Civil War, when the Confederates would be having a party at a plantation, and they'd be dancing the quadrille with their wives and their fiancés and promising they'd be back before Christmas and the war would be over. It was this false sense of not security, but that what was happening was impossible. You know, that what was happening was so absurd that it couldn't possibly come true. And if it did, it could be easily handled because obviously people were people of reason and civilized and wouldn't allow such things to happen to their friends and neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good parallel. There were, I mean, it took, some people were quicker to recognize the danger that was brewing around them when Hitler came to power than others. And it's hard to know what, where one would fall on that spectrum. But many, I mean, I think of how quickly we normalize things in our own daily lives. If someone says something really rude, if a stranger says something really rude to you on the street, at least for me, my first impulse is to normalize and to think, oh, I must have misunderstood that, or that I'm, that can't be right, because the forces of civilization are so powerful, and I think that those can work against people in recognizing really outrageous things happening sometimes.
Right, and the problem is that it's the civilized, the good, if you will, people that are most easily taken in by that type of ruse, you know, that you can't possibly believe that Kristallnacht happened, or that how could people do something so inhumane, and that's, you know, the night that the party is set, too. But it does, definitely does have some parallels, and it's funny, I know your book's going to be compared to All the Light We Cannot See and The Nightingale and all the other books that, you know, deal with this topic, but I think the difference, one of the differences is that you really do show in a way that doesn't blame, the way that someone could grow up looking forward to participating in the Hitler Youth or in a youth group that was devoted to exercise and sport without thinking that there's something wrong with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think that one lesson that I took away from, or something that I thought about a lot anyway when I was doing this research, was that a lot, terrible things don't always have recognizably terrible beginnings. There can be, you know, good and appealing elements that wrap and obscure an inner horribleness. And that certainly, I think Hitler did a very effective job of packaging Nazism as something that had a lot of great promise and allure for communities and for people looking to improve their lives and looking to feel proud about their country again, and that, you know, there were many reasons why people in the beginning, if you were focused on what was immediately unfolding right in front of your nose, you might not see the forest for the trees.
Why don't you, before we begin to talk about the qualities and characteristics of the women and the story, and since we're here to sell books, why don't you give a little better summary than I did in my introduction of the book so that we can get the readers started off on the right foot?
Okay, I liked your summary, but I will basically the women in the castle is the story of three widows, three German widows who come together in the immediate aftermath of World War II. It begins in June 1945, and they are trying to rebuild their lives and get back on their feet in this abandoned castle in Bavaria. It has no running water, no electricity, and they kind of have to craft an existence for themselves here with their children and reckon with the past as well as try to forge their way into the future. And as it turns out, reckoning with the past is kind of a never-ending situation. They have to look at their own lives and the choices they made and the actions they took or didn't take, and they also have to ultimately grapple with each other's lives and those choices. And in some cases, they find they're not what they thought they were.
Marianne, do you pronounce it Marianne or how do you pronounce it?
Yeah, I say Marianne. Okay. I think in German you'd say Mariana.
Okay. Well, she's a very righteous woman, and as she herself discovers, perhaps somewhat self-righteous. And she takes her job that's been given to her, bequeathed to her, very seriously. Would it have been possible, do you think, in Germany in that time, to do what she did, that is, track down Benita, track down Martin, track down Anya and her children? Would it be something that would be doable if you really worked at it at the end of the war?
Yeah. I mean, I tried to make everything in the book very rooted in possible fact. It's obviously a work of fiction, but I really wanted to try my best to adhere to the circumstances of the time. And yes, it would be very difficult. Everyone was looking for someone. I mean, the buildings in Berlin were plastered with, you can see photographs of them, plastered with missing posters, basically. People leaving letters for the person they had last seen at that spot. I mean, the whole continent was kind of shaken up. There were 20 million displaced people floating around Germany at the end of the war. And these were people who were concentration camp survivors. They were laborers who had slave laborers who'd come from the east and been working at factories and installations in Germany. They were Easterners who were had fought alongside the Nazis against the Russians in places like Ukraine and Lithuania. And so it was obviously the challenge was extreme. But I think one of the things that helps Marianne in my book find these fellow widows is that she's very well connected, and because her husband was a resistor and was also had a lot of colleagues in America and England, he was in the Foreign Office under Hitler and before that, I sort of played on that to have it be that she kind of was able to disseminate a list of people she was looking for to various powers that be, which helped her locate two of them, although presumably there were many others on her list as well who she had not turned up.
One of the things that was fascinating that I didn't know about, just kind of going off topic, is about how the Allies after the war did that thing where they made you go to the movies to watch the liberation of Buchenwald and also the posters they put up on the walls. If you could talk about that a little bit, because that's where that shame feeling comes in.
Yeah, to me that was very profound, to see these images of posters that went up in town squares in Germany in that summer of 1945, where there were the images that we know well today, the horrifying images taken on the liberation of Buchenwald and Dachau of, you know, emaciated human beings in these bunks or piles of bodies. And these images went up in town squares with things like, who did this, you did, or these sins, your guilt. And to me, it was very profound to imagine what you would think as a German walking by those, especially, actually, if you were a German who was, again, quote-unquote, ordinary German, who had, you know, the degrees of knowing what was happening can be parsed endlessly. Like, if you are one of those people who says, we didn't know, and I'm not quite sure what that means in reality, I think it was hard not to, certainly couldn't know that Hitler was anti-Semitic. That was obvious that he was anti-Semitic, so I think it's not imaginable conclusion, and then here you are faced with it and also faced with your own complicity. What do you do with that? And definitely there were not a lot of conversations at that time happening, from what I understand, among Germans, and I think that's partly because it was such a desperate time where food was scarce, coal was scarce, commodities were scarce. Everyone was kind of trying to put one foot in front of the other. They were living in, the cities were totally bombed out. There were, many people were living as refugees. So, yeah, grappling with that moral substance while going through your regular daily life seems fascinating to me, and was something that I really, that was one of the impulses that made me want to write this book.
What was, I had not known about that campaign by the Allies, but what was even more shocking in your book was the fact that there was almost a kind of, and I can envision it because of what's going on in the world today, almost a kind of backlash against that program, like, we didn't do this, this is propaganda by the Allies put up that it never really happened. There were actually people that felt that, right?
Yeah, and I think that that was partly a carryover from Hitler's own propaganda, where he was telling people who, you know, by the end of the war, terrible rumors were trickling back to the German people of what was happening in the camps in the East, and I think there were even some leaflet drops from Allied airplanes with, I'm not sure if there were images, this was hard for, I'm not clear on whether there were images of the concentration camps or reports from the Allies describing them. But what Hitler's line and Goebbels' line on these were, this is propaganda, this is totally the Allies making this stuff up, and if there were any images, what they're of is the German soldiers being held in the Russian gulags. So I think a lot of Germans still held on to that idea as a way to explain what they were seeing.
Yeah, as we were saying, you know, Marianne's position is a black and white position, and that black and white attitude that she has throughout the book sometimes comes back to kick her in the butt, kind of. But it does give her the moral high ground for a good portion of the work. But then now Benita she's a woman who's a beautiful woman and has used that beauty, but she's also somewhat both physically and morally kind of not lazy but lackadaisical. And how did she come out that way? How did she come out that she gets to the point, and I won't spoil it, but when she says to her hopefully betrothed, what she says that line to him at the very end, I don't care if you were, I would still love you. How does she get to that point in life where she's unwilling to let good or evil affect her decision-making process?
I guess I felt like she was a person who was really living the life that was immediately in front of her, and she has never been terribly curious about the larger world or her role in that larger world or human existence in general. She is really driven by her own needs and her own desires, primarily for the bulk of her life until the war. Her main desire is to get out of the small working-class town that she was born in and which she feels she's too good for, and she wants to experience the world in a different way. And that has been sort of her driving concept, and then the war comes and explodes that, and she's left kind of picking up the pieces, but she's not really morally equipped to deal with the level of, know, for lack of a better word, the level, the depth that is required of a person to reckon with what has just happened. And she sort of sees that in herself and realizes that she's lived a life that's very much about love and human relationships, and that's what drives her and that's what she's interested in, and she doesn't feel she really has the mettle or the depth to deal with the larger picture. But then on some... That all sounds kind of dislikable, and I hope she isn't totally dislikable, because on some level I feel she actually had the most, in terms of the experiences of the people right around her and the children and the other women, who the friendships that she creates, she actually is in some ways much more intuitive and engaged than someone who's more morally black and white and is always seeing the big picture like Marianne.
Yeah, I know, and that's really well brought out in the beginning when Marianne first meets her at the party, and And I guess as the reader and the dilemmas you pose for us, you know, I'm like Marianne. I'm going, well, you know, she's beautiful, but what's she got going for her? But then I realize Connie falls in love, you know, Connie's in love with her, and he's a really cool guy and really smart and, you know, has everything going for him. And so there was a moment there that I picked up what you just said. And then when you had them sitting talking initially in the beginning of the relationship when everything was really great, their flirtation, she did have wit. And she did have skill in, you know, banter and things like that. And
I think we all know people who other people are drawn to, and it's sort of hard to describe why sometimes. It can be kind of an aura or an energy or however you want to put it without sounding terribly new agey. And I thought of Benita as one of those people who's got a real, there's something very compelling and appealing about her.
Yeah,
but
you have everybody's.
It's hard to put into words.
Yeah, and you do. You do put it into words, and you have, you know, everyone. You have everyone's head turning at her, and they're turning at her, one, because she's beautiful and she has her hair plaited like that and all that. But they're also turning because there's something, like you said, almost like an aura about her.
Yeah, sort of very purely human element to her.
So then, if you move on to Anya, who's in many ways the most complicated of the three. And without going further into that, because that would come up with spoiling, definitely spoiling, Anya has got this work ethic, and she's got this pure idea of good and evil in a certain sense, but in another sense, she's all screwed up. And she's one. I guess she would be one of the ordinary Germans, right?
Yeah, I think that she's a thoughtful person who is also, as you said, she's got a strong work ethic. She's also very pragmatic. And ultimately, I think what she is reckoning with after the war is having seen things wrong and having been made the wrong assessments with the best of intentions. So she is kind of the most enigmatic, I think, in the beginning of the book. And hopefully by the end of the book, you have a better grasp on how she got where she was.
Yeah, it's interesting because they all. Did you see what I was saying in the introduction, where you put the reader in a position of, you know, uncertainty? Do you think that's good that
yeah.
you do that?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think I wanted to do that, because I feel like so much of our understanding of that time comes from this really certain perspective of the ultimate, because it was ultimately revealed to be such great evil, what Nazism amounted to. We tend to see things in this really black and white way, and it almost, the stories and our sense of understanding of how this all came to pass gets kind of shut down by this sort of villains and victims narrative. And I think that we have so much to explore in the gray areas around that narrative and in the sort of everyday lives and small decisions that everyday people were figuring out during that time that comprises really the bulk of what the population was experiencing.
It's funny, it's the dilemma I wake up with every morning is like, you know, what am I supposed to do? And it's also funny that yesterday at the library in Philadelphia, Anthony Doerr appeared and was talking about All the Light We Cannot See, because it just came out in paperback. And he was talking about the exact same thing and coming at it from a point very similar to yours, that I think pretty much he was saying all you can do is, if you're a writer, is write well. If you can volunteer to do something, do it. If you can make a change, no matter how small, do that as well. And that's a really hard thing for me to face, because I kind of feel like I just want things to change right now. You know, I wake up in the morning and everything's fine, and then I go, oh, wait a minute, Donald J. Trump is president of the United States of America. And then my day changes. It's affected my health. But
right.
And so I just want it to be undone, I feel. And it's funny, interviewing most authors are intelligent. And so all authors that I've interviewed feel the kind of the same way I do. And so what happens, I find, is that authors who write fiction in which they create a person, like, I mean, Marianne, Benita, and Anya are more real to me than the 7 billion people in the world I don't know, and I'll remember them for the rest of my life. So you've created a reality for me. So instead, when I wake up now, I feel like I'm living in a fictional world. It's like all jumbled up.
Yeah. Well, I would say that you're doing really important work in having these conversations, because to me, when I think about what I can do, which I sometimes, you know, we all can feel very powerless against big forces in our time. And at least one thing that I think studying that period of immediately after World War II and even during World War II that I take away is that people, for various reasons, sometimes for their own physical safety, were afraid to talk about things, and they did not want to examine and publicly, criticize, question, whatever it was, because I think that that's so important. Even in the aftermath of the war, people didn't do a lot of that initially, because for many reasons, partly because it was so painful. But I think that looking at difficult things and talking about them and asking questions, that's actually a kind of doing.
That makes me feel better. at least it sounds like I'm doing something. Before we end talking about the book, I have to talk about the children, because, you know, you have Elizabeth and Katerina and Fritz for Marianne, and then you have Martin, and then you have Anselm and Wolfgang, and finally the young Marianne, and then even with regard to Benita's boyfriend, you have Clotilda, who actually figures more in it in a certain context at the end of the book than kind of almost in an epilogue kind of way. So all these children, they resonate. They're like harmonics. They're like wind chimes. They aren't their parents. They aren't their fathers or their mothers, but they all take something from their parents' situations. And that was very skillfully done by you, I think.
Oh, thank you. Well, I feel like the children are an important part of the story, partly because, I guess, since I'm a mother myself and I have three kids, and it feels like these women were mothers and they all have their children, and that's it's the number one thing in your life when you're in that place. So they were very organic to the story. But then I also wanted to explore where they were. I mean, part of why the book ultimately ends up in the present day, or not the present, but it ends up in the 1990s, is because I wanted to see those children again and see and be a little bit in their heads as they kind of processed what their parents had been through and what their parents had done and not done.
And also with Martin and Marianne, the younger, they kind of help bring the novel to a resolution without, again, giving away too much, but they really help move things along at the end, just like good children are supposed to.
That's right. Well, I think that part of our children, part of what we do as children, and we hope our own children will do, is try to know us, right? And we try to know our parents and know our grandparents. And that ultimately is what I felt like the children in this book are trying to do.
And they did it under very difficult circumstances, and it was a hard job for especially Marianne to accomplish. Well, Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about the book. It's a wonderful book. I have an independent bookstore. It's called Wellington Square Bookshop, and Real Simple Magazine just voted us the best bookstore in the state of Pennsylvania. Maybe someday you'll get to come by and see it.
I would love to.
And your book is out there on the front table now, and I've been really pushing it because it's I think, a wonderful book. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
We were talking to Jessica Shattuck, the author of The Women in the Castle. It's a book about, like many other books out now, and that have been popular, about Nazi Germany, but it approaches it from a slightly different way. We learn about the evil of the Nazi Empire, and we learn about the subsequent failures of people afterwards in acknowledging their blame, and also what the survivors of this mess had to say about things too. But what it does is it talks about ordinary Germans, and which brings us to our own situation today, as we talked about. And I won't say any more about that, but it's something that resonates with me on a daily basis. In any event, thank you so much. She was a wonderful guest. And thank you for coming by and listening. But so we have coming up, we have a bunch of authors, but the next one up, I think, is going to be Paul Theroux. Paul Theroux is a travel and food writer, but he's also an excellent author and a very biting and scathing, almost Roald Dahl type person. And he's written this book called Motherland, which is about a mother who controls a brood of children who are rapidly aging and who are awaiting her demise and then the possible good fortune that may come with it. But it's really funny, really scathing, and a really fun book. It's a big book, but it reads really quickly. So I hope you'll join us for that one. So anyway, thanks as always for coming by, and we hope to see you next week here on The Avid Reader.